How do you think our experience of life is going to change in the future?
It's already changed. You know, that's the thing that we don't realize. Most of us wake up, we check our phone. That's the first thing you do. You look at your emails, you look at your messages, then you go into some chat group of some sort, or you go to TikTok to stream videos for hours at end. We already live in a virtual world. It's just a very inefficient one.
Welcome to The Human Experience, a brain observation podcast series where we talk about what it's like to be human, life's struggles and joys. Sanad O. Karkar is the seasonal bird with a law degree and an impressive track record as repeat entrepreneur. He has launched several successful projects in the past and is currently the founder and CEO of Zero Code, the ultimate NFT launchpad designed for brands. Here we sit down and talk about the future and how the human experience is going to change and merge with our digital presence. What is the next phase of our online existence, and how will it affect how we live, interact, and experience this world?
Welcome.
Thank you.
How was your morning?
Very good. Hectic a little bit.
I can imagine. When you have small children, it's impossible to have a calm morning.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been tough. But yeah, I'm preparing. I'm moving cities for the winter, going to Spain. So there's been a lot of preparations and packing everything up and getting ready.
You're like a seasonal bird.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Fly down south in the winter and fly back north in the summer.
That's amazing. So you have a deep interest in Web3, the metaverse, NFTs. All of these are things that is next generation of our online existence.
Yeah, decentralization.
And historically, humanity has kind of received great change with skepticism. Mm-hmm. What do you see? How do you see people taking this?
I think there's a lot of misunderstanding and misconceptions of what is the metaverse, what is Web3. There is no single term that defines it today. Web3, metaverse, both of them are kind of like interrelated in a way, but they're not in another way. Because these terms are just grouping together a bunch of ideas that over time, as they start working together, they will establish what is a metaverse. Mm. So let us look at it from an evolutionary perspective. We can maybe start with one of them because they're two different topics, right? So we start with Web3, right? So we look at Web1, the first version of it. That was purely informational. It was from like 1991 till 2004, approximately. And it was basically kind of like the internet was a giant Wikipedia with hyperlinks connecting things together.
Yeah, I remember that.
Right? You are just a consumer of information. Yeah. You go in, you search stuff, and you get out. You don't put really much inputs yourself.
Yeah.
Web2 started emerging from 2004 till today. Mm. And this is with the rise of social media, where suddenly you can have your own inputs. You like something, you comment on something, you interact with something, and then your data is stored. And then they can start pushing to you ads and information that is more likely to be targeting things that you're interested in. So, of course, there's the rise of privacy issues, centralization became a thing. Big companies like Facebook, Google, YouTube just came to emergence. And as you can see as well, the transition that happened from Web 1 to Web 2, it wasn't like a single technology that is called Web 2. It was so many different things that just emerged.
Yeah, I didn't realize that there was a shift even. It's with Web3 that I understood that there was a Web1 and Web2. I had no idea. Yeah. It's the internet.
Yeah, exactly. It's just the internet. It just evolves over time.
Right? Yeah.
And this is exactly what's happening now with Web3. So what is Web3 really? Well, it's a host of things. Part of it is about decentralization. Everyone is focused on that. So you no longer have to rely on third parties for storing your data and pushing things to you. You own your data. And that's a revolutionary concept in itself. You know, there's now like different platforms are rewarding customers for their attention, right? So with attention tokens.
Yeah.
So there is new alternatives of thinking about how do we interact with the internet and how do we interact with centralized parties. Another part of it is more related to finance. And that's when you come to the crypto world. And they use, you know, decentralizing finance, DeFi. That becomes a huge thing. Another part of it is governance, right? So in a Web2 world, or a Web2 world enabled like companies like Facebook to become public listed, and then they'll have shareholders, and then they'll have board meetings, and then they'll have a CEO, and then the board and the shareholders decide what direction the company goes on. And then, you know, the CEO goes to execute it, and he has his hierarchy of orders that cascades down to the organization, and they do things. In a Web3 world, we see the emergence of, for example, decentralized autonomous organizations, also known as DAOs. Mm. And DAOs take the concept of shareholders existing, and those are the token holders, right? But removes the CEO as a role. You don't require a CEO to execute on the wishes of the holders. Instead, code does everything. So code replaces the CEO, replaces the processes, and everyone believes in that code and they do it. In theory, things like that, you know, are still very early in their evolution, and they are susceptible to hacking, because when you create code and you list it, it has to be open source because you have all these, you know, shareholders. So anyone really wants to attack a DAO system can do it very easily by just looking at the code, testing it out, deploying it themselves until they know the attack works, and then they can steal money, they can steal information, they can steal whatever they want. And so I'm kind of diverging a lot because it's such a big topic, but what I'm trying to say is that there is so many different aspects that defines what Web3 will be. And it's mainly focused on decentralization.
And when you talk to people about this, do you see excitement or do you see skepticism mostly?
Both. Excitement, skepticism, and also when will things happen? Right. And it's kind of similar to the internet. We don't know when things are going to start like reaching mass adoption and you're going to see.
It's a gradual process.
It's a gradual process.
It's like slowly trickling into something new.
Absolutely.
Have you noticed a difference between the people that are excited and the ones that are skeptical? That it's kind of like, is it mostly entrepreneurs or people in the space that are excited? Or can you talk to people that have no idea about these things and they go, wow, that seems awesome?
Yeah. It's really hard to define because nowadays, we're seeing a lot of more acceptance for Web3 concepts and decentralization in mainstream, you know, mainstream companies are starting to adopt Web3 technologies. We see giant brands like Starbucks change its entire loyalty program into rewarding their members through NFTs and through tokenization through the Polygon blockchain network. We see Nike is doing a fantastic job by entering both the metaverse and Web3 world of communities. We say Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg recently was in an interview with Lex Fridman and he was talking about that, you know, the metaverses that are going to succeed are the metaverses that are going to enable this exchange of assets between one metaverse to the other. And that can only be achieved through decentralization to keep it in a most transparent way. So what that means is that if you have an avatar in the Facebook metaverse, you should technically be able to take it to Roblox and use the same avatar. If you bought this swag, the clothes, the shoes in the metaverse, you're able to take it with you. But then who owns the data? You as the user should own the data in your own wallet, not a centralized party. But of course, when you think about gaming and especially the metaverse, to do that is quite impossible. As of today, there is no standard protocols that governs like the transfer of, let's say, this jacket from this one metaverse to this other, because they have completely different graphic requirements. They have, you know, different technical requirements. So the transition is not as smooth yet. So we are still at a very early stage between seeing these metaverses connecting together and using decentralization as, you know, a powering tool for it. But the work is being done. And I think realistically, we still need like another 5 to 10 years before we can see like mass adoption, really.
How do you think our experience of life is going to change in the future?
It's already changed. You know, that's the thing that we don't realize. Most of us wake up, we check our phone. That's the first thing you do. You look at your emails, you look at your messages, then you go into some chat group of some sort, or you go to TikTok to stream videos for hours at end. We already live in a virtual world. It's just a very inefficient one. And I think what metaverse entails is beyond just playing a video game. It's about augmented reality. It's about virtual reality. It's about on phone digital game experiences where you can interact with others and meet them in a more unique and more human way. And that's really the aim of the metaverse, is to more humanize this process and turn it to like kind of like an organic experience.
And when you say organic experience, what do you mean to humanize it?
Yeah. So for example, you know, again, Meta are working on their concept of the metaverse, and they have these Oculus Rift goggles that allows you to enter the virtual reality world.
Yeah.
One of the, you know, breakthroughs that they have developed recently was the ability to enable the eyes of the character you're talking to match your actual eyes. So you can actually have eye-to-eye contact
in
a virtual world. Yeah. And it feels like you are looking at a person in their eyes when you're talking to them in the metaverse. And that alone, psychologically, I mean, you know more about psychology than I do, but that tricks the brain into believing this is an organic experience. This is not merely virtual.
But what do you think that does when it's, do you have the entire facial expression, entire body language?
Even the facial expressions, the muscles, there's sensors that picks that up. So if you smile, move your lips, it's moving in real time. But they discovered that the eye contact was, it is one of the most significant things that makes people believe that the person they're talking to in front of them is not a machine, it's a person.
So it gives like a 3D experience to a Zoom call.
Yeah.
Basically, where you can see the person, you can see the body language, but it's a 2D.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And because it's immersive, when you go into like a 3D kind of rendered world through virtual reality goggles, there's no distinguishing it from reality. It's just that the character looks a bit funny because the technology is not quite there yet. But over time, like the Unreal Engine is producing very lifelike experiences. And once that technology reaches that stage, I think we're gonna be conducting most of our business meetings and family reunions virtually and, you know, help the planet from reducing carbon footprint, but also being able to never feel homesick. You know, you miss your parents, you miss your kids, you miss whatever they're studying abroad. You can just connect with them at any time.
Do you think it's going to make us feel less lonely?
I think so.
Rather than more isolated?
I don't know, to be honest. It would be very hard to predict that, but I would like to use it. I mean, my family lives in the US, I live in Sweden, and so it's really, you know, during COVID, that tested us as well. Like, we couldn't travel and meet each other. And so if I had the opportunity to, like, have a coffee with them or just, you know, in a virtual, I would have done it.
Yeah. Because there is a hot debate around our digital presence and living digitally, and especially around children spending a lot of time on screens. And what I see is that most of that debate is quite negative.
Yeah.
People are seeing it as this is a change from the good old times where kids would be out running and playing and we would actually interact with other people on the bus instead of just staring on our phones and the kind of effects it's having. What's your take on social media? Is it good? Is it evil? Is it something in between?
I think it's a technology, right? It could be used for good. It could be used for bad. And this will apply as well for the world of the metaverse when we head into that. Because right now, bullying on social media is a big problem, right? Mm. Like, a lot of kids are getting depressed. Some of them are committing suicide, unfortunately, due to cyberbullying. But cyberbullying in the metaverse could be a lot more intense.
Because it's a lot more personal.
Yes.
You're living the experience.
You're living the actual experience. And you can do more horrific things in a virtual world than you can do in real life. Right? And and how do you govern that when that happens? That's a big question, right? So any technology is subject to abuse. But then on the other hand, what I would like to understand even better with current social media, as you were mentioning, well, there is that part where we need to censor certain things. But then that begs the question, who are we to play, you know, censorship police? Is there infringements on freedom of speech? When does it go too far? And this, you know, debates are happening right now with Twitter when they, for example, like silenced Donald Trump or silenced some doctors who were not really agreeing with the WHO organization, the CDC, etc. You know, there's camps as well that talks about that. And I don't think that that will ever stop. That'll be like a continuous debate. And decentralization, it becomes a bit of a threat to censorship as well, because censorship is needed for certain things, right? Mm. You can't just go fully freedom of speech on everything. There's certain things that are harmful. There are certain things that needs to be censored. But then when you have a decentralized system, in theory, things cannot be censored. You know, you release a video that is harming someone else, but you cannot take it down because it is decentralized and distributed to different networks.
Mm.
Right? So everyone has, you know, a server. So there's no central server where Facebook or Google can just switch it off and say, remove this video forever. That can't be done.
What do you think about the aspect of the psychology of the user? How much that affects their experience of this digital world?
Have you tried it? Have you tried playing any virtual reality games before?
I've tried in like the, you know, the one where people usually get seasick.
Yeah.
If you hang out in it for too long, you start getting like a bit woozy. So I've tried that. That is mostly like skiing or something like that.
And how did you feel when you put the goggles on and you were in a virtual world?
I just thought it was really kind of exciting. And still, it was still a bit like when you started using computers and everything was in squares. It was still... you can see that this is a fake world.
Yeah.
And it is a bit like you're moving around in a video game rather than I'm moving around in a different world.
Yeah.
So I think the experience was a bit more like being in an amusement park where you were experiencing something that was a bit out of the ordinary and fun, but obviously not I'm flying through space.
Okay. Okay. So I think that really answers it in a way, right? For most people, it's going to be just that. It's going to be like going to an amusement park. It's going to be an entertainment tool, right? Some people already play, for example, World of Warcraft or, you know, Dota, and they're addicted. They spend, you know, every waking hour just playing the game and just hitting the next level. So there's going to be that, I think, as well in virtual reality. Some of us, we're going to use it for entertainment purposes. Some of it are already using it for educational purposes as well. And some are just going to be gaming and doing the same thing that is happening today, just a different medium.
So we might be more isolated in our homes, maybe not venturing out so much, but you think that the social experience is still going to be there?
Yeah.
That we're still going to have that social connection?
Yeah, absolutely.
But without the feeling of touch then from other people?
Yeah, exactly. So you'll miss that for now until they fix that.
You think they will? Because then you're going to have a bodysuit or something.
Or they can implant a chip in your brain, like Neuralink, where they can simulate like sensory stimuluses.
Ah, yeah. Right? A lot of really weird things are going to come in the future. What do you think about people that are scared of this or that are very skeptical or that are having a lot of resistance toward this change?
Yeah, I mean, you cannot fight change, right? You just have to adapt to it. And like any technology, there's good uses of it and there's bad uses. Try to focus on the good and try to get the good out of it. And, you know, govern how you want to manage these things. You know, don't get affected by it. That's the only way that, you cannot stop progress, unfortunately.
Why do you think they resist?
Being scared of the unknown. You know, already the world is pretty toxic when it comes to social media use. And we see the content that is happening from, you know, like the Kia boys who are teaching kids how to hotwire a car and steal it. I have a Kia, so I'm not really happy about that. But, you know, like, you know, it could be used for bad, but there's also a lot of educational and informational use for it that could be very beneficial. And yeah, just try to be the positive force of change rather than hiding away from it, right? Be part of the conversation. Otherwise, you won't have your voice represented.
And why are we scared of the unknown?
Because uncertainty. Uncertainty always, you know, makes us, you know, we have this, I think, reptilian brain. You're more likely to respond to fear than to respond to rationality. You know, what is it called? You have to help me with this. You have the frontal cortex, which is responsible for
planning, executing,
executive thinking. Mm-hmm. And then you have the amygdala, which is responsible for your basic, you know, needs of survival. Flight and fear and
it's filtering inputs from the world to put a salience, to put a value on it and to tell the brain if this has an emotional value or not. Is this something we need to put focus on?
Yeah.
And then it can kind of run through the reflexes where we get scared, we get stressed out, a fight or flight kind of reaction, depending on what it is.
Yeah. In my brief readings, but you summarize it so much more eloquently than I did. But exactly. So I think that's why people fear things. I mean, that's the first response. The second response is calm that fear down. Once it calms down, you're able to understand. And once you understand, you're no longer fearful because there's no longer uncertainty. You kind of get it. But of course, some fears are justified. Not all of them are imagined, right? As we talked about, like, the possibility of cyberbullying going to the next level, criminal activities in a decentralized world. If YouTube and Facebook and Twitter are all replaced by decentralized platforms where data cannot be governed anymore, that's a problem as well that we need to consider. How do we solve for that? So there's always, of course, people have some valid fears and some of them are irrational.
What do you do when you get scared of things?
When I get scared? Oh, God. Honestly, I allow myself to panic for a little bit. I need to get it out and then take deep breaths and try to like slow down the thinking. So deep breaths work actually. If you breathe deeply and that helps you just calm things down and then you can think clearly.
And when you think clearly, you talked about how looking for the knowledge.
Yeah.
That if you look for the knowledge, then it's easier to find some form of acceptance.
Yeah, exactly. If you can understand something, then you will most likely fear it less.
Mm.
And then understand your role in it as well. And this is why I'm a huge advocate, to be very clear. I'm a huge advocate for decentralization, huge advocate for it. I do realize that there's a lot of risks as well, but that's like the case with everything. But the idea of ownership of your own data, retrieving some of your privacy back is tremendous. Today, the world is controlled by centralized big companies. They also see the problem in their model, but that's the model that helped them thrive. And the future is going to change. It's going to be more empowering people. And similarly, like the use cases specifically for finance and fundraising, and of course, you're going to find a lot of fraud cases, but eventually it's just going to democratize access to, you know, equal economic opportunity for people around the world to participate in the world economy. Mm. Today, it's reserved for a few countries and few citizens of countries, right? The rest of the world does not get to participate, but that's the power of Web3 and what it can do. It can democratize this entire process of economic opportunity.
What do you think is a mental skill or a mindset that would help a person thrive in this kind of new reality?
What kind of mindset? Oh, wow. Just be adaptive, learn fast. That's the only thing I can do. I think adaptability is really important. And especially for entrepreneurs in this space that want to, I'm not sure what your question was targeting. Is it targeting entrepreneurs or individuals experiencing?
I think more an individual.
Yeah.
Just a general human. What do you think is going to delineate people that are thriving more in this space when it comes to their mentality, to their mindset, to their skills of the mind?
I honestly don't have an answer for that. That's a tough question. I don't know. Because I don't see it as, you know, you have to use the metaverse, or, you know, you have to be part of a Web3 community. You don't have to, but it's much better than the alternative. It's a good way to gather people that are interested in one thing. And this is the other thing about the emergence of Web3 communities. And this is an area that I really love. So in the NFT world, we saw an explosion of NFT projects and memberships for you to be part of these projects. And what is really nice there that you can build now a community of really passionate people about a specific topic, and they can be anywhere in the world. And by holding a token that is part of this project, one, they're funding a project with a specific roadmap that will deliver on their, you know, interest. Two, they get to govern that community and they get to support it, grow, and let the project continuously, you know, run. You look at Bored Apes Yacht Club, valued over $1 billion. Started with some, you know, pictures of a monkey and an art project, then it turns to a lifestyle brand, turns to a membership. And what is really unique about it, that everyone in that community continuously gets enriched by the progress of this project as it goes and their support for the project. Mm. And we see that happening in different projects, World of Women. There's so many NFT projects that are doing that. And that's the early, I think, it's kind of like reminds me of the early days of like social media, when social media just gets started. Only the college kids, like Facebook started, were just inviting college and American university students, specific universities, expanded to global universities, and then they let the masses. But that was their go-to-market strategy. I think in Web3 today, like you're seeing a lot more Gen Z, you're seeing a lot of millennials are in that space. So it's primarily people between the ages of 18 to 35, 40, that's the main demographics. And they're building these really cool communities, they're building applications on top of them, they're creating their own gated content and gated merchandise, and they're building industries from it, really. And it's all happening through community-driven projects. That has never happened before in the history of humanity. And I think that's the really potential that I like to focus on, because I'm like, okay, so what is my interest? For example, you're a researcher in neuroscience. So if you guys want to, for example, fund a research that you really wanted to fund throughout, you know, your career, but haven't had the opportunity, haven't found the interest, you can launch a community and gather people that have similar mindset, or they would like to see an outcome from that research, and they can fund it, you know, so funded by the people. Now, of course, there's a lot of regulations about where you get your funds and et cetera. There's the KYC thing, and that will be dealt with, but then that opens the door for alternative ways to get things that people really care about. And I can see the potential of it specifically in these, you know, genetic diseases, for example, that are not very common, but there still is a sizable amount of people suffering from it.
Globally, but not in one small community.
Exactly.
But when you talk about that, you gather small communities that have a very specific niche interest, and they meet up together. It reminds me a little bit of the algorithm of TikTok, for example, that finds what you're interested in, and then it pushes that towards you. Yeah. But what happens with a lot of this, and as well with the targeted ads through Google and things, is that you get a reinforcement of your current beliefs. So you have less and less of a wide perspective. You see less and less of beliefs that are opposite your own. And I think you see that a lot within politics as well, that through this online presence, we're reinforcing the beliefs we already have. And that might have an effect on how we grow and pro-sociality and how we interact with other people? Are we then going to become more and more entrenched in our own already belief systems?
Yeah, there's the polarization of, you know, opinions. That's happening all across the world. Mm. You know, you're either this or you're either that. You can't, you know, we're blending the gray zones. It's either black or white. Yeah, that's dangerous. And that's mainly a practice by centralized advertising platforms that thrive on this practice.
Because what I'm thinking there is the brain has a natural bias towards finding information that can reaffirm the beliefs that you have. It's pattern recognition. It's trying to find things that are going to keep you safe and things that you're focusing on. So if all of a sudden something becomes important in your life, you're going to see more of that. What I think this online existence does is that it's kind of facilitating that. We already have this bias, and now it becomes something that is targeted as well. Mm. It becomes amplified in this existence. And I just wonder if that's good or if that's bad, or if we need to counterbalance that with intentionally training our mind more towards perspective taking, towards working with our beliefs, finding out if they are actually adaptive or possibly maladaptive, to figure out how they might differ from other people and how are we going to be accepting of that.
Yeah.
To think about this pro-social aspect so that we don't create those little communities where you're only talking with people that have the same ideas and views as yourself, because you lose a lot of perspective that way.
Yeah, but that's the thing is, right? I agree with you. I think we need to be more considerate of different views and not get into that rabbit hole where you just believe in what you believe in, and then you're reinforced by other people that believe in the same thing, and then you become like unable to distinguish truth from propaganda, right? Ultimately. But how do you do that? You can't force people to train that way, right?
You can't force people to do it.
Yeah.
But you can educate people around it, and you can inspire people to do it.
What I would think would be really cool, if before you can join TikTok, you have to take some videos, like educational videos about how to distinguish truth from the algorithm, right?
But that's the thing. What is truth?
Yeah.
Because truth is based on perspective.
It's subjective, yeah.
It's very subjective. So the reality we're living in, I am living in my reality, the things that are based on how my brain developed and how I see things in the world. So I'm going to experience the exact same occurrence in a different way than you're going to do.
Yeah.
So there is no absolute truth.
Yeah, true.
And that's still going to live in this online world, because we are still going to be governed by our brain and by ourselves, our personality and who we are. So I just wonder if a lot of these psychological things that are already going on, if they are going to be amplified, and what that is going to lead to. If it's going to become this thing where it just increases until it crashes.
Yeah.
And then we figure out a new way to deal with that. Or is it going to increase the differences between people, where people who have certain psychological stability or certain mindsets are going to be able to thrive in a way that people who don't have these resources won't be able to do?
Or they could still thrive within their community, right? And that's the thing that I find very interesting right now. There is, as you said, like there's like this polarization of people. And of course, some people have more advantages based on their education, but that's always the world. The world has been always like that. Depending on your education, your upbringing, your, you know, the values you hold determines really your success in life. So if you have a bad start, you know, I'm not saying you cannot climb out of it. You can, but it's going to be a lot harder. You're going to have to put a lot more effort to get out of where you are to move up in life. But people, some people are handed like, you know, that silver spoon from the beginning, and they have an easier way. And I think the same thing is going to continue. It's really up to parents, especially right now, more than ever, you know, to make sure that they are moderating the use of social media, educating their children about how social media should be used and how it should not be used, and they understand how the algorithms work. I think that you're right. There should be more education about how the algorithms work and how they perpetuate a specific ideology. If you just happen to watch a video for 3 seconds, then it knows that you're interested in more videos like that and keeps pushing these ideologies on you. You should be aware that this is happening. I think awareness is key. Awareness is key.
How do you reach awareness?
That's the tough part, right? Like, I fell victim to this myself. Like, I watch videos and suddenly I'm getting more and more and more videos about this one specific topic. And then I believe that this specific topic is so epidemic. Like, it's everywhere. There's a problem. But then I talk to other people that are on a different topic. They're like, what are you talking about? There's a different crisis in hand. Have you heard of this? I'm like, nope. Like, I'll tell you, like, the funniest thing is I was watching Joe Rogan talk about, like, UFOs, right? That became a huge thing where with the Pentagon declassified UFOs, whatever. So I watched that one video. And then after that, I was bombarded with so many UFOs. I was going around telling my wife, I'm like, I think there's UFOs. And she was like,
The
floodgates were open. I was like, I think they're real. And she was like, what are you talking about? I was like, the Pentagon released it. Japan released it. She was like, why is it on the news everywhere? I'm like, it is. And I'm like, she was like, I don't see it. I'm like, but it's all over my social media. And then I just kind of occurred to me. I'm like, hold on a second. I watched that one video.
And all of a sudden, all of this.
Yeah.
Because what is interesting about that is children and adolescents and young adults up until the age of 25, you still have this more passive plasticity. The brain is not fully developed, especially the frontal lobe is not fully developed. So they are more impressionable by their reality than we are. So what happens is, their experience of the world is going to shape their brain, and it's going to become kind of a loop where their brain is going to be more responsive to certain things, and then they're going to have more and more of those things in their world. It's going to change how the brain actually develops. It's going to change how the brain wires in children and in adolescents more than it does in adults. We can definitely change, and that's what we do under the right circumstances, but we have a little bit more of a gap where we can decide on it. As you said, you realized, hey, wait a minute. Maybe this isn't fully true. Maybe I'm actually falling a bit victim for this algorithm and the way that it is working. And you can take that and you can analyze that back. Children and adolescents have that to a lesser extent.
Yeah.
So you said that as adults, you need to help and moderate their social media existence. But can you moderate it? And how would that be?
Yeah, I think that's a tough question. I mean, my kid is too young for that. But my wife is already like, she has very negative views on the use of social media for children. But I think it's also kids feel left out if they're not on social media when they are with their peers, you know, at school. Everyone is talking about this next video. And so you cannot have them also become pariahs or the ones who are like outliers from their crowd. So just, I guess, as you said, like education at home, you know, conversations, trying to understand where their head is at, what are they looking at, what are they, you know, thinking. And I think that will give you an indication. But what you've mentioned really like brings a really good topic. It's, shouldn't that responsibility be with social media companies?
But we're decentralizing them.
Exactly. But see, this is the beautiful thing about decentralization. Technically speaking, with Web3 communities, as they exist today, it's an active choice of you to go and seek the community you want to be part of. It's not pushed on you, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a completely different thing. Because today when you're on TikTok and you're scrolling like through videos, you see one video, then they push you to the next video and the next video and the next video. And right now, search results in TikTok have exceeded Google and YouTube, which is crazy. People are using more TikTok to search for things, recipes, how to do
things. I know. I know. It's amazing. You learn so much.
Yeah.
You can learn so much. It can be an educational tool if you choose to use it as one.
But the algorithms are problematic. And this is the same reasons why Facebook was criticized for their use of the algorithms in a similar manner. You know, you're polarizing societies. You're affecting the mindset of children when they're watching a certain thing and you're reinforcing it over and over again. As you said, they're impressionable and they should have a responsibility.
So how do we use this as an opportunity? How do we see this as an opportunity that we've never had in history to help shape healthy, thriving brains, flourishing brains in children? How do we help them instead of go into this rabbit hole of extremism or negative content or cyberbullying? How can we use this as an opportunity to instead build compassion, self-awareness, these positive skills, gratitude, optimism as a way of reinforcing those things in a way that is more efficient than we might have been able to do before.
I honestly think regulation. Regulation really makes a huge difference of the type of content that should be, you know, when you have to create an account, you have to be like verified your age and thing. And then when you have someone's age, you should probably, the algorithm should probably prioritize a specific type of content over others. And it's funny because this is how TikTok works in China. China does not allow anything to be published, right? A lot of content is considered obscene. It's forbidden in China, so it's censored.
Yeah.
So the algorithm of TikTok in China works completely differently than it works here. So there, people find more content about kids hacking things and building things and developing things. It's more positive, less so about horrible trends, you know, stealing cars or throwing bricks from bridges on cars.
These are threatening all things, your Kia.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Threatening my Kia's existence. but that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'll never embrace China's censorism. That's nothing that I'll ever embrace. But I do think some sort of regulation when it comes to the algorithms and how they target children, specifically underdeveloped minds, that is very important. It can't be willy-nilly they're getting whatever content that is out there.
What do you think is the challenge to this being done? Is it being done enough today? And if it's not, why?
Because it's not profitable. It's not profitable. It needs to be addictive. You know, they know what you like. They want to push more content for you. And then you're hooked. You want to stay on this platform because it reinforces your ideas and you feel positive about yourself.
So are the people we need to work with the people that are in control of these things?
Exactly. That's the problem with centralized organizations, right? They have too much power of what they decide people see and what they don't see and how the algorithms work. And they build the smallest things in the UX and the UI of these platforms to make them more addictive, right? This little notification that you get, the little sound, the little bing, the little, you know, these are all adding to your addiction. And they know that because they want more users' eyes on their app for longer hours. And that's what dictates their value as a company.
Mm.
This is how much they're worth when they want to advertise, right? Mm. So I think, you know, the future is that we need to look into these things really seriously. Regulators need to look into these things very seriously and make sure that these companies have no other option. You either do what we tell you or get out, right? And I'm specifically talking not about censorship of speech, obviously, because that's a cause that I hold very close to my heart. I believe most speech should be free. I wouldn't say all, because anything that incites violence or anything like that, of course, should be banned. But generally speaking, if there's difference of opinion that is offensive to someone, it's okay. You have the right to be offended.
Mm.
And the offender has the right to offend you as long as it doesn't cross these lines of violence. But when it comes to children, that's a completely different topic. And that could not be taken lightly, right? And, you know, the EU did that recently to Facebook about the privacy laws. They said, if you don't abide by these privacy regulations for your tracking of users, then you're not allowed to operate in the EU.
Mm, that's a big thing for them.
Yeah. So I think
it's a very big incentive.
It's a very big incentive. They're like, yeah, just, you know, either get out of Europe or do this. And, you know, Facebook threatened that we'll pull out of Europe. They didn't pull out of Europe. They can't. They can't afford it. And I think the same thing should be approached with other companies, and especially TikTok right now, more than any other platform, because it's growing rapidly. It's mainly Gen Z. And
the algorithm is new.
And the algorithm,
it's very specific.
It's very specific.
Yeah.
And the fact that it operates differently from one country to the other tells you that there's something, you know, can be done. It's just that not enough regulators in more European countries have applied any pressure on them yet. Because I think regulators are a bit always too slow to respond to things, you know. They need more data, more studies, more issues arising. And then they're like, okay, what can we do about this? And of course, there's always that thing about the whole, you know, companies have a lot of autonomy in conducting themselves. And it's difficult.
Do you think things are moving faster and faster?
In what terms?
When it comes to change.
Yeah, I think so. I think regulators are getting a lot more conscious and they're learning from the past. You know, the whole Web2 sprung on us without us noticing. As you said, you never realized.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know when that happened. Yeah. I don't remember.
There was
that starting.
A defining moment.
Yeah, like now is when it. Yeah. It was more internet. Yes, I remember when that kind of came out and the way the adults, because I was a child, and the way the adults were talking about it. But then the gradual change of internet, I've never been aware of it happening.
Yeah.
In other ways than when smartphones came out and you started using it on your phone and this whole kind of revolution.
Around 2011.
Yeah.
That's like the introduction of iPhones, and then suddenly everyone was like...
It became different. You were online anywhere, and not only on your computer, your stationary computer. We didn't have so many laptops even. So if we go back and look more at the general human experience when it comes to psychology and human existence, what would be a mental skill that if we could just disperse it in the tap water, it would have the largest impact on society?
Staying objective. I think that's like rational thinking. Yeah, I would say that rational thinking. Rational thinking is really missing nowadays.
And what is rational thinking?
Being able to take any piece of information that you're given and try to realize whether there is any objectivity to it, whether it's just mere opinions, and whether these opinions are backed by anything that you can actually believe in. Right. So you have to kind of like trace things a little bit and just really expand them a bit more to find the truth. And I think that's a skill that they used to teach us. I studied in the US, like, and when you start university, there's always some kind of like a university introduction orientation type of program. And, you know, rational thinking, deductive reasoning are among the first things you're taught as a student. Right. That's what you need to learn, how to think in that way.
And how not to fall into the trap that you're filtering the information to see the things you want to see.
Yeah, I mean, luckily we still have, you know, the internet as from the days of internet web 0.1, where information exists. You can Google it, you can search things, you can really dig deeper into any information you pick on, rather than just believing some guy on a podcast talking to you, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I think that's really important, fact-checking, right? And that's the best tool, I think, because if you have a figure who you're listening to and you're believing every word they say, and then after some rational deductive reasoning, you do some, you know, fact checking and you figure out that, you know, they're full of, I don't know.
They're full of something different.
Yeah, they're full of something different. Then their whole credibility crashes. You will no longer listen to that person. And I think that's the key, I think, mental skill that you need to develop is that.
To sit back, take a moment.
Yeah.
And go, okay, I have a feeling about this information. I have emotions around this information. I have thoughts around what this means. How can I take a step back from that and find other sources?
Yeah.
Find different sources and their opinion and their perspective on the same thing.
Yeah.
And then work with all of that information to find something that Absolutely. Might be more balanced.
And unfortunately, today, like even in the media, like it's so hard because most media outlets became either right-wing, left-wing, because they're following the algorithm. So it's also hard sometimes to find the right
polarized.
Information.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have to get a little bit from here, a little bit from there, and then just try to find like a middle ground. Like the New York Times for me used to be like the objective source of information because I really valued their journalism. But even nowadays, I can see a lot of articles popping up that is more opinionated towards a specific, you know, political way of thinking, let's say. So yeah, it's a challenge. And, you know, the objectivity and the truth, as we call it, the truth is very hard to find today. It's funny because I remember at one point I searched how the news looked like in the 1970s and 80s.
Ah, yeah.
And I wanted to compare it to today. So in the 1970s, you have this guy, or 80s, you have this guy who would stand in front of the screen, or girl, and they would say, we have the story. This happened. And then there's 15 minutes of him just talking about the story.
Yeah.
No visuals, nothing. Just a person and a voice. And he's just giving you details of the story.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's like they're giving you a whole analysis of a war that is happening, like example, Russia and Ukraine. Within 3 minutes, and during these 3 minutes, there's three interviews. I don't know who can get like 30-second interviews in with experts. How much information are you going to get out of that? And you have tickers on the bottom, tickers on the top, stock exchange, you know, market analysis. There's like other news happening. And I'm like, how do people focus? How do people get any information out of the media outlets today? It's impossible in comparison to before. And I felt like, well, maybe if someone is telling me a story on the news, like for 15 minutes describing one very basic thing. I don't know, this penguin was just born today at the zoo. 15 minutes, you know, news, like presentation about it. Then I can understand everything about this penguin. I can go research this further.
But people would scroll.
Yeah. But nowadays, because the attention span is shrinking. That's another thing that is happening. Attention span is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. 150 characters. Then you have, you know, for Twitter, and then you have these short videos, 30 seconds.
You have 9 seconds to get a hook in.
Yeah, exactly. The first hook. And people use baits now to hook you in.
Yeah.
It's a baited hook. Yeah, it's crazy.
So what do you think about focus, the importance of it, and what's happening to us?
Yeah, I mean, focus is nice.
How are you going to be able to do this perspective taking, this looking at going, this is information, I need to think about it, I need to reflect on it, I need to look at different sources, I need to make up my mind about it. How do you do that in a short attention span world where things are characterized by emotional imagery, characterized by hooks, characterized by algorithms that will push you towards a certain thing, and you will get the information extremely fast, just kind of like passing by you? How do you combine that lack of focus then with being able to have this perspective thinking?
That's tough. I have no idea, to be honest, because there is also an advantage for this fast information. We are now today processing a lot more information than we ever did in the history of humanity, right? So this is what I always think. So this is from neurologists. I would like to get your perspective on it as well. For me, I feel like the older I'm getting, the easier I am to follow what I call gut feeling when it comes to listening to things. Mm-hmm. And what I feel the gut feeling is just basically all the weights of experiences that I've had in the past that have proven me right or wrong and gives me this ability over time to be able to process this information faster and be able to take the right decision. When you're like, think about artificial intelligence, for example, in the beginning, it's faulty. And then with more data, more experience, it learns to detect things faster. And I think, for a trained person who's constantly digesting information, you can start adapting to this new world where information is fast and stuff. But it has that other side of it that you will get bits and pieces of information and you're not really, don't have much depth into anything. You just have a lot of shallow information about everything. Mm-hmm. And this is becoming the reality. Whether it's good or is it bad, I don't know.
You make up your own story from it.
You make up your story, yeah, exactly.
And is that story then a reinforcement of the beliefs you have? And are those beliefs serving you or not?
Yeah.
And is it serving society as a whole?
Exactly. That, I'm not sure it's it.
Because that is true. The gut feeling that you're talking about is the brain is constantly using sensory input. It's taking the information in, it's processing it in different ways, and it is creating maps. Yeah. It is creating maps in the brain of things that you've already experienced. And whenever new information comes in, it compares it towards this map against it to see if there is an error margin somewhere.
Okay.
And the thing is that if you have a lot of networks with certain beliefs, a lot of networks that are quite fixed, they are going to have preference over how you filter this information. We do have networks that serve as well, but we also do have a lot of networks that don't.
Okay.
And the way this happens is that through development, you have the most plasticity in the brain and you are the most impressionable when you're a child. And this is happening when you are living an experience of which you have no control. You have no control over your circumstances. You're creating coping mechanisms to be able to live in this experience that you have no control over, that people are imposing on you. When you grow and as you become an adult, you're still trying to cope with that experience, even though you're not in that circumstance anymore. So I think that is what creates some of the mismatch, where sometimes we feel I am stressed out about something, I am angry about something, but I don't really understand why. And these networks can sometimes serve as well, and sometimes they don't. But if you keep reinforcing them over time, your gut feeling is going to become more and more in line with this. So it takes an intentional awareness to look at that, to become aware of what is actually going on in the back of my mind. How can I work with this? What is serving me? What is not serving me? What is serving others in how I respond? How is my behavior affecting people around me? And what can I do with this? Because if we're not aware of how our brain is built and how this is affecting our experience of life, I think when things are going faster and faster and faster, we're going to become more and more entrenched in this. And there is a risk that anxiety levels that we have might increase because we become deeper and deeper and deeper into this thing. And most people today have experiences from their childhood that aren't great. Most people have coping mechanisms that aren't serving them so well as adults. And this is affecting a lot how we interact with each other as a society. And I am very curious about how these things are going to function in this future world. Mm. And I believe that what we need to do is to be aware of that, to think about that, and to intentionally work with that in order to be able to use this new online existence in a positive way,
yeah.
in order to utilize the opportunities in it, in order to see, okay, this is new technology that is actually kind of cool and that can have a lot of effect on us as people. How can we use this to make something awesome?
Mm-hmm.
How can we use this to help us work with these things?
Mm-hmm.
How can we use this to create a society where we have more access to psychological support, to understanding ourselves, to reducing stigma around mental health? How can we work with these things to create something amazing so that we can flourish as people rather than becoming entrenched in just reinforcing what we already have?
Yeah. This is really fascinating because it's quite interesting how childhood trauma, and trauma is a very broad term. Trauma could be anything. It could be separation and anxiety when you're a kid to something a bit more serious. But it really impacts the way we think forever.
Yeah.
Or, you know, unless you
actively
try to change it. Unless we
intentionally work with it, yeah.
But I heard from psychologists in this space as well that they say that even when you try, you will slip. Because it's kind of like you get pre-wired for certain conditionings.
Mm.
So you have to consciously, always, when you slip, try to retrace and stop and think. But it takes a lot of effort that you can never really break out of that. How do you see that as a neurologist?
I don't think that's true that you can't break out of it. But
yeah.
I think what we're trying to do often is we're trying to look at, okay, this is what I should do instead. So I should be more grateful. I should do these affirmations. I should be more compassionate. I should practice my empathy. I should train these things, which is great. But there are obstacles to why we don't already have these things.
Yeah.
And these are the subconscious neural networks that are running in the background that are created by these core beliefs, that are created by these coping mechanisms from when we were a child. So my belief is that we need to do it at the same time. We need to deconstruct the old patterns that are not serving us whilst we're cultivating skills of the mind that do. Because then gradually there can be this shift where you get a better balance. But it's true, as they say, that if you work on developing these positive skills and trying to just become aware of the problems you have, you're going to slip.
Yeah.
But I think we need to understand where we as an individual are, what our obstacles and our resources are, and what is the best mode to work with those to gradually make this shift. But what I think is can be dangerous is if children and adults are not invited or taught how to do this. Because then with social media and with this metaverse and with everything that is happening, can be a reinforcement of the brain that you already have in a way.
This is exactly what I was thinking right now. I'm like, how would that impact the development of people when they start losing specific things that teaches us early on how to react with others, right? Like this intimate personal connections that you built at a young age determines your emotional stability, right? And if this is taken away from you because you're too distracted, you're augmenting it with virtual experiences, what would that lead to? Would we become more of an introverted society? Would we become more reclusive?
Or would we enter those communities where people are thinking the same?
And then feel comfortable, yeah.
Feel like the information that we're getting is the correct information, and just go deeper and deeper into that. So we become like a collective recluse.
Yeah.
We become like a collective hermit where we're living in this shared experience without bringing other people in or without going outside of it.
More homogeneous society.
Well, kind of like a heterogeneous society built in homogeneous subs.
Which is really...
And what will then happen when these subs need to interact? Because they will.
Yeah, they will interact. But then that's when they have different schools of thoughts, and that's when they start waging battles against each other in the virtual world, which happens today, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you have these right-wing, right now, emergence of people like Andrew Tate, which I'm sure nobody, everyone has heard of Andrew Tate. He got banned recently from everything. He's just been deplatformed, right? So, like, he emerged, but there was a lot of people around him, like Jordan Peterson and a list of, like, conservative right-wing thinkers. And then you have the left-wing thinkers as well. And they live in two, you know, separate universes, but they're constantly battling on the chat forums, in the comment sections. And now, take that to the next level, where there's actual virtual realities, where people are playing video games in and they're interacting with each other. So it's no longer just sending a message. You can actually be sabotaging each other in a virtual world, attacking each other's homes in the metaverse, because you can build houses, you can build lands, you can build things. Like, would that become like a full-blown war between the left and the right, right?
Yeah.
But in a virtual world, that's the kind of things that I always wonder about. And what would that mean in real life? You know, what are these attacks? And deplatforming as well is another thing. Like, when you deplatform someone, like, what does that do to their followers? Does it further reinforce their ideas that there is someone out to get them?
Most likely.
Right? And what do we do about that? Do we allow speech that we consider not agreeable with our values? Or do we let it exist? If you ban it, does it become stronger? If we let it stay? So what are your thoughts in terms of these kind of, you know, polarized opinions entering specific societies? For example, in Sweden. Sweden is a very egalitarian society. And then you have people like Andrew Tate, who is the opposite of egalitarian, you know, spreading his messages. What do you think its impact, for example?
I think the next phase of human well-being is to move into something called flourishing, move into something called thriving, where you're not just okay, but you're actually cultivating positive skills such as gratitude, compassion, optimism, self-awareness, perspective-taking, finding a better balance between negative and positive thoughts and emotions, because you're always going to have those. It's not about removing negative things. It's about finding a balance. It's about understanding it. And it's about expressing it in a different way, and also being able to have a stronger pro-social sense, where you have compassion for others and where you seek understanding of others. And I believe this is something that more and more people are looking for and more people are talking about. This is where we want to be. And I believe that this is more and more necessary as well in order to be able to use this coming future for good, in order to see the possibilities, in order to use it to create better and better experience for people, so that we don't end up in reinforcing things that are not serving us, that we're enforcing instead things that are more pro-social. And you can do this.
Yeah.
All of these things can be modified. All of these things can be worked with in different ways. And I believe this is where we're heading when it comes to human health. And we just need to find ways to integrate this with the other things in society that is taking place, and to have this coexistence where we work with each other in a translational way and where we learn. Because I think what we need to do more and more as a society is to practice skills that makes us more pro-social, that makes us see commonalities with others, that makes us see what do we have in common, and to become more compassionate. I believe that is going to be the solution to many of these issues.
But don't you think the world is becoming a lot more empathetic, more compassionate than, let's say, 10 years ago or 20 years ago? At least that's how I feel when I look. You know, mental health was never addressed. You know, growing up as a kid, we were told, like, you know, you're a man, just be a man.
Yeah,
that's no longer the case.
We're in the beginning of this evolution. Yeah. It is starting to change, and it's starting to shift. Yeah. There is more research going around the area, and there is more interest among people in general. So we're definitely in the beginning of this, and people are seeing the importance of this. And I believe that we need to encourage this and expand this and really go with this parallel to all of these changes that are going on in order to deal with potential challenges that are to come. Because to some extent, maybe we were a bit caught by surprise by this, because it was a fast expansion from the internet coming to to the social media, to the smartphones, to where we are, it's kind of a short span of time. Absolutely. So maybe we didn't have time to adapt the psychology in society to this new world. But now we're starting to catch up with the importance of it. That, hey, maybe there are certain aspects of this that is not serving our mental health, that is not serving our well-being, because we don't really know how to deal with it. We don't really know how to interact in this new world. We need to figure that out. And now we're trying to do that in parallel. And I think that's a really important aspect to keep in mind. And when working with communities and Web3 and metaverses, to take in knowledge from people that are more in the psychological space and go like, hey, what could be potential obstacles here? And how can we support people to thrive in this and to be healthy in this and to use this for good? How can we adapt this for that?
So this is one interesting thing about Web3 communities that I really like. Generally speaking, if you're in the space today and you're communicating with people in the Web3 community, everyone is so positive. Everyone is so nice all the time. Sometimes I'm even, you know, skeptical of how nice people are. Of course, they're happy when things are going well. Now, what is becoming really stressful for people, and there's a lot of things, we call this rugged projects. So being
rugged projects.
Yeah, rugged projects.
Okay.
So that means like someone launches an NFT collection with a certain purpose, a mission, a roadmap, whatever, cultivates a huge following of people that really believes in this mission, goes and invests during the public sale of the NFT. They go buy it. Suddenly there's 3,000 users that have put together $1.5 million, $2 million, $3 million, depends on how much they raise, to follow the project. And then suddenly the project owner disappears, right? And they call it rugged, as having the rug pulled from under you, right? So you've been rugged. And what I really found interesting, because I've visited some of these communities, and some of them are rugged because the founders are scammers from the beginning. It was a scam. They built something that they had no intentions of doing, and then they just pulled it out. The other way that is happening is that the communities are becoming unforgiving, right? Now you don't have one stakeholder. You have 3,000 stakeholders, and these founders are trying to fulfill their needs, but they're never satisfied. They want more and more and more and more, reaches to complete burnout while the project completely disappears. So we're seeing that happening as well. And the stress level and the expectations that is rising with these platforms as well makes it a lot more of a challenge now, because you don't only have people that are commenting, you have financially invested people.
But what does it mean that they want more and more? What is it they want more of?
For example, you launched a collection and they want airdrops. They want you to create more artwork for them, or you said you're going to deliver like an online game that they get to play with, and the game is not up to their standards. They want it to be better, right? Because they're your investors, essentially. And they can create...
Because they feel like they have put some monetary into it, so they deserve to have higher quality.
Absolutely. Or whatever they consider is the quality they want. You know, they want more from the project. The project is not doing enough. Other competitor projects are doing better things. Change your roadmap. Add more things. And when it becomes like governed in that way, this is where it's really interesting with NFTs, because when you buy an NFT from a collection, let's say you buy an NFT from Gucci, right? You're not only buying an NFT from Gucci as a collectible, you become like an investor in Gucci. You have a voice. Your voice is valued much more than someone who is not an NFT holder. And it becomes kind of like a bragging right with membership, right? And this is the world of Web3 that is happening. It adds a lot of accountability, but it also gives really stressful environment for creators and people building projects, because it's no longer that you could have, you know, raised some money from family and friends to launch your project. You're fundraising through a community, and this community can turn against you all of a sudden. And if it turns against you, how are you going to deal with it?
So you see creators being overwhelmed.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why most projects fail in this space. It's because a bunch of good friends want to build a project together, and they're enthusiastic and they believe in something. But then when they raise their initial funds and they start delivering, and the community is still not happy with the delivery,
and there's a backlash. They pull out because they can't deal with it anymore. I can't create in this space anymore, because I cannot psychologically deal
with the stress,
with what is happening.
The expectations as well. It's high expectations from everyone. And once you're burnt, your card is burnt. right? Like you cannot launch another project because everyone in the community would know you as a fraud or they would label you and whatever things. So you kind of get your cards burned, which is justice served if you were a fraud, but it's kind of sad if you did your best and you failed. And this is another reality of Web3 communities, which is, you know, it's always positive as long as things are going good. When the floor price drops, people are not happy.
Yeah. And do you think it becomes more complicated because money is involved?
Of course. Of course. It's money, but it's also like I find it to be emotional investment. Some people I saw in communities, they start creating their own merchandise for the brand. You know, some people spend their own money to advertise this NFT project because they believe in it so much. Mm. So people get really emotionally, financially invested in these projects because it means something to them. Right. They want to build a community of, let's say, people that are passionate about any topic from cannabis to mental health and well-being to research to the list goes on.
Toy trains.
Yeah. Toy trains or, yeah, exactly. Stamps, collectibles, whatever. You name it. Pokemons, you know, it's out there. But they get really, really passionate about it because it's nothing like we've experienced before. I never felt passionate about any brand that I bought anything from. I love Starbucks, love their coffee, love their products. But I wouldn't be like messaging Starbucks on Facebook, I don't like the new mochaccino that you've released. You know, this is horrible. But in an NFT world where I'm investing in where I feel at least like I'm investing in the brand.
So when people feel that they have a voice, yeah, they use it.
They use it, absolutely. But this is a good thing, right? So this is why I say like, it's going to weed out the bad projects and it's going to bring out the good projects. And I think this is what really Web3 communities and NFTs have the potential to do, is to create, for brands specifically, super fan communities, real advocates. And this is why brands are jumping on it. McDonald's, Burger King, Starbucks, they're all jumping on the wagon of launching NFTs, rewarding their members. But it's also rewards because NFTs have monetary value because you can resell them on the market. It doesn't belong to a centralized server. If Starbucks goes bankrupt, I still have that collectible. I can still sell it. You can trade it. You can gift it. You can create passes from it. You can do so many different use cases with it that it has never happened before. And that's the true power of this technology. And this is why I get excited. This is why I'm building the space, because I feel like we're going to have more responsibility on companies as well when you have stakeholders that are so vocal. So let's say there's a scandal on hiring practices or mistreatment of employees, like Starbucks right now, for example, like they're unionizing all across because they wanted better wages. Same thing with Amazon. Mm. Now, suddenly, your community of investors are going to be very vocal about you doing the right thing. Mm. So this, again, adds accountability. And I think most people innately want to do the right thing. Mm. People don't want to do bad things. Mm. And this is where we can counter a lot of these bad practices in this new emerging world and how the technology is evolving.
There's a lot of interesting things to come. And it's been an absolute pleasure sitting here talking to you about this, about the new future and how we're going to navigate this. And I think a lot of really good things are to come. But as you mentioned many times, there are challenges that we need to figure out how to deal with. Absolutely. So thank you so much
for
coming.
It was really great. Thank you.